Welcome to Season 3 of Pierpoint Perspectives, the Securities Finance Podcast. This season focuses on technology providers that service this community. We'll be talking about securities finance systems, as well as cutting-edge technology applications that service investors and hedge funds, taking new approaches, including AI and robotics. This season brings you the choice of video as well as audio, with the podcasts in all the usual places and the video casts available on our YouTube channel. Strap yourself in as we go on a tech ride to the future, brought to you by the consulting team at Pierpoint Financial. So now, over to your hosts.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 4 of Pierpoint Perspectives, the Art of Securities Finance. I'm your host, Roy Zimmerhansel, and practice lead at Pierpoint. This season, the focus is technology, the improvements, the current and coming changes, and the disruptors. And we're looking at the investment community holistically. The genesis for today's show was a LinkedIn blog post I did on the collapse of Wirecard. That post reached and triggered a response from an old contact of mine from the world of prime brokerage and one of today's guests. He let me know that their system had flagged up Wirecard as a problem a considerable period before the implosion. The key thing is that the identification of Wirecard wasn't because of strong investigative work, whistleblowing, or number crunching by analysts. It was triggered by artificial intelligence. And that really grabbed my attention. He showed me the reports identifying red flags along the way, and we talk about Wirecard actually as part of the episode that's coming up. I've had numerous exchanges with the people at Blue Fire over many months, and I'm convinced that in addition to their existing clients and applications, this has scope for securities finance. Anyway, before I steal any more thunder from this show, let's get to it with my guests, David McIntosh and Doug Ray. So listen, guys, thanks very much for joining us today. Really looking forward to this one. I think this has real potential to impact a number of different businesses. And the whole idea of this series is about technology, not just for today, but how it will actually shape the sort of the wider industry in investment activity over the coming years. So thanks for joining us. Maybe I can ask you to introduce yourselves first. So Doug, maybe you can start off.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Doug Ray. I work at Blue Fire, actually here in Europe, in the UK. Prior to joining Blue Fire, I spent 15, 20 years in institutional equities. Starting out as a Japan specialist and global equities. So I work with a lot of our asset management clients in equity and credit, and I have some involvement in product design and some of the elements of the product around things like financial health analytics. So yeah, really looking forward to the chat today.
Thanks very much. And David, the whole reason we're having this conversation is because you connected up to me not too long ago after a very long time.
A long hiatus, indeed.
So maybe tell us about yourself, David.
Yeah, look, not too much. David McIntosh, hi. I head up distribution for Blue Fire in APAC. Spent most of my career on the sell side, largely in prime brokerage, which is where Roy and I know each other from our misspent youth in Prime, but from the humble beginnings of Prime through to various investment banks, finishing up at BNP in 17, where I met Blue Fire, and life took a different path into the world of fintech, which is where we are today.
Yeah, look, and I think Prime is a great example of an industry that it wasn't until the last 6 months that I actually realized just how much we were part of the formative years of it in the 90s and early part of this century, and how really, when I was at Nomura and we were setting up prime brokerage for the first time, we specifically didn't hire people from the leading prime brokers because they already had their technology in place. And what we needed were people that were used to doing things manually so that they could actually program new automation with new technology, new capabilities, and actually create a new, better version of their previous firm. So I see AI as very much in the same place. We've been talking about AI for a long time. You know, we've been reading about it and it's been sort of developing, but really, in my view, it seems to me from all my discussions in this tech series is that we're in the early stages of it. So maybe you guys can tell us what Blue Fire is and what the goals are.
Sure. So look, I'll take that one. Blue Fire was founded in 2016. The two founders, Samir Rath and Luke Waddington, met and had an idea that through the usage of large data and new technology, we could improve how decisions were made. Lots of money had been spent in the industry automating the execution layer of the industry, ultimately arriving at two things, size and price. But very little had been spent on thinking about how we can use new technologies and science to make more informed decisions. So from pretty humble beginnings in 2016, with a core value proposition of enhancing decision making, Blue Fire today has a wealth of customers around the globe who see value in the way in which we can enhance that decision making capability. And really where we focus in on is risk. We tried to sell alpha to the street. The street said, go away, no thanks. But guys, yes, there is something that you've brought to the table here in illuminating unforeseen risk. And by unforeseen risk, we all talk about risk. It's got many different definitions. I actually looked in Investopedia before I joined today to see what their version of risk was and found 15 different versions of it. But maybe it's important to think about how we define risk. So in principle, we work with institutions who have an active interest in active risk. And by that, you take the view that you have an interest in pragmatically repositioning risk in your portfolios, whether that be in equity or credit. Why would you do that? Well, you want to avoid drawdowns, you want to protect capital or rep risk. There's many varied reasons as to why in which you would take risk seriously. But certainly by illuminating unforeseen risk, we found a niche in the market, and the market seems to be coming in our direction to that way of thinking.
Right. So you talked about the community of people you're trying to serve, but can you sort of narrow that in? Who are you trying to target for this kind of, risk enhancement or risk information sharing?
Yeah, sure. We operate across three broad verticals: investment banks, asset managers, and wealth management, which includes private banks. And if you think about those three broad client types, we take investment banks first. We're working with collateral management groups, margin lending groups, and risk departments, all areas who are interested in rising and falling degrees of risk in companies that they're monitoring and managing. Asset managers, obviously, there's a complete use case there because typically they're paid for performance. I probably caveat that we typically work with active managers, not so much a friend to the passive community, but certainly people who've got an active management stance. So that brings us into hedge funds, active, sovereign, people for whom see benefit in repositioning risk in portfolios with a forward-looking lens that we bring to the table. And finally, wealth management. We see a huge opportunity in the wealth management space. There's been little automation brought and little enhancement to the decision-making there. And we really think we can help that industry and by definition, help the people that wealth management is providing product to in protecting returns, protecting capital, and hopefully outperforming.
Right. Now, listen, I get all of my knowledge and learning from Wikipedia. So I'm completely with you in your search on risk. But can you give me a little bit more on what you mean by risk and how you guys identify the risk or sort of bring it to the fore?
Doug?
Yeah, sure. So, that's quite a nice segue, I guess, into the problem that we're solving or that we've been brought in to solve in most of our engagement. So if you think about risk, the way most people in the industry look at it, you can kind of bucket into two things, right? You've got your betas or your kind of rules-based risks, and then you've got the idiosyncratic stub that's left over, the kind of unexplained extra bit that sits on the side. And what we've learned is that the industry is very, very good at managing beta at this point. It's very, very good at managing known risks that can be managed with rules-based systems on historic data. What it has a huge blind spot for is idiosyncratic risk and tail risk. Anything that is unpredictable or unexpected and single stock specific or single credit single issuer specific, the industry is really, really vulnerable to. And, you know, I think you and I have spoken in the past about things like Livedoor in Japan. We've obviously seen, you know, Wirecard last year, and, you know, these kind of situations, Steinhoff, there's so many of them. And whenever they come, they're incredibly damaging and painful, but the industry keeps getting tripped up by them. And there's a reason for that, because they, those kind of risks are fundamentally really, really difficult to spot, and certainly very difficult to spot within the framework that the industry has right now. So that's the kind of the piece that we very specifically focus on, is idiosyncratic risk. And we're very, very good at tail risk. And that's kind of where I think we found the niche that people were interested.
Okay, well, I want to come back to it, maybe not right at this moment, but yeah, the reason that David reached out to me was Wirecard, and apparently it wasn't that difficult to spot according to your system. But let's take a step back in what we were talking about, what you were talking about there. Maybe you can tell us how you go about identifying those risks or trying to help people with that idiosyncratic risk.
Sure. So if you think about the reason, the way you've got to do everything is you've got to have a good framework for what you're doing. And I think that's something where a lot of new technology sometimes goes wrong, because you can have very, very powerful AI or machine learning, but unless you know what problems to aim it at or what questions to answer, then obviously you're not going to get the answers that you want. And so the first thing is, let's figure out, why is this blind spot here? Like, why does the industry trip up on these kind of risks? So think about what describes, and we can talk a bit more specifically about Wirecard, but let's think about what characterizes a big single stock collapse or a big single kind of issue, a default or kind of credit breakdown. So there usually is something there. You can see something over time that tells you this is going to happen. But the thing that will characterize it is, it's going to be sparse data points. They're going to come from different types of data sets. So it won't be kind of all in the same place. It'll be little pieces of risk or news here and there. And there's a certain kind of non-linearity to it, which, if you think about, you know, for those who don't know what that means, what it basically means is collapses don't happen in a smooth kind of line like that. What they do is they go, this is fine, everything's fine, this is all fine, nothing's fine, and it breaks. I mean, sometimes they even go up and up and up and then they break. But that kind of shape of breakdown, plus the fact that it's not many data points and it's data from different types of sources, think about what that means. The way a traditional quant model or a quant department, the way our entire quant industry is set up, literally you couldn't design something that is more kryptonite to that kind of setup. Because the way the industry looks at quant is, you know, lots of data points, you know, that can be nicely structured together. And then they have a smooth alpha curve or a play out that you can model and you can then trade around or position around. And so these kind of, the way these things happen just doesn't work with the quant industry. And these are skill sets that almost no one in the industry has. And in fact, very few people in the world have. And we know, because we've had to go and source or build new mathematics and new skill sets to deal with them, but they're in very short supply on the quant side. The industry does have some tools that can deal with those kind of problems, and they're called human beings. So experienced analysts and PMs and fund managers and risk managers and traders, that's what the human brain does. It naturally can deal with not many data points, with lots of different types of data point. And they can understand that nonlinearity, that feeling of like, oh, I feel like there's a cluster of badness growing on this thing that makes me nervous. Like, human brains can deal with that. They can think in that way. But the industry has obviously been firing everyone or juniorizing, or the people that are left are so drowning in information and the complexity and volume of information and data is so high, they just can't cope with the volume of these things happening. So what we've basically done is tried to solve both of those problems, which is the industry needs something that sits in between human and machine. And it needs either a way to augment humans to allow them to have the scale and the capacity of a machine to look at volumes of information and to kind of help them cope with, you know, and apply their natural thought process to, you know, thousands of stocks instead of I mean, what's the average industry analyst coverage? 15, 20 stocks? You know, if imagine if your analyst with 20, 30 years experience could cover 100 stocks or 500 stocks. So that's one approach. Or can we take the quant model and apply, this is where you're really applying genuine AI. And we can talk more about what that means. But, you know, can we take it from a kind of blunt instrument, high leverage equals bad, to, you know, or like tech equals good, energy equals bad? Can we take it from something as rudimentary as that to something that's just much more nuanced, that has some element of like the way a human would look at stocks and can kind of understand and think in a different way? And so that little space in between is, I mean, that's where we live. That's where we spend our entire life. And I mean, as I said, we can talk more about the nuts and bolts of how we do it, but that's, you know, conceptually is the first step. Like that's where we sort of go.
Right. So maybe from that kind of high level explanation, maybe we can actually look at Wirecard as an example and take us through that. So obviously last year, Wirecard provided a lot of content opportunity for people like me to share my thoughts and views. And David, you got in contact, I guess, as a result of something presumably that I wrote or put in video or whatever. Maybe talk us through what triggered your interest and kind of what our next discussions were about.
Well, I mean, certainly I saw the piece that you posted. It would have been LinkedIn. Wirecard was a thing at the time. I think the interesting thing with Wirecard and any other collapses, as Doug mentions, is we've all watched the show Minutes from Disaster on Netflix. So I kind of look at these events as one of those zoomed out views of what happened to the plane before it took off, as it got into the air, people are comfortable, everything's fine, and then everything's not fine. And, I mean, Doug sort of alluded to this before, but having been at this now for years, when we look across the vast array of collapses that we've been performant in picking up on, it does seem to be that consistent moments from disaster piece that occurs. It's not always the same, but the way in which we pull a company apart is through four distinct lenses: forensic accounting, balance sheet cash flows, behavioral profiling, market data analytics, and event extraction from news. Looking at a company through those four lenses, we do find that there's uniformity in collapse. And Wirecard is no different. It is no state secret that there was accounting irregularities going back as far as 2018. Well, Emmeline, who was the outward expression of our technology, Emmeline doesn't have a view on Wirecard. She doesn't have a view on any one of the 10,000 companies we monitor. But what she does have a view on is when there's deviation from pattern. And I think when I got in touch with you, the comment might have been something around, would you be interested in having a look at what we were saying in 2018? And what we picked up on in 2018 was, for the first time ever, Wirecard's accountants had brought in a deferred accounting regime to a balance sheet process that never before had deferred tax assets in the balance sheet. Well, everyone simply sees that and says, red flag. Why? Because when we compare company to history versus company to its 10,000 others, and we look for those patterns of breakdown, we know that when a company has no history of deferrals in its accounting practices and they bring that in, there's a probabilistic event that something is going to go wrong. And Doug's a lot closer to it than I am, so I don't want to steal his thunder because he really is the guru as it relates to balance sheet analytics and FactSet information. But that was one of the first sort of triggers for us that got us looking at it. When I say us, Emmeline, it's not us. We've certainly trained the machine as to how to operate as best we can, to attempt to replicate how a human being would look at information and try and assimilate that into a decision. But the nature of how machine learning models work, when they do tether on something and they can see that there's some sort of price breakdown attached to what they found as an event, they're very good at hanging on to that and looking for other events to attach to it to create that waterfall moment of risk signal. So I'll pause there, maybe pass to Doug, who'll have a more in-depth view on Wirecard, if you want to go.
Let's carry on with that, because that is kind of interesting. So someone that was actually following Wirecard, an analyst, might actually have seen that and just go, oh, that's interesting. right? And so it is that kind of parallel between what a human does and what a machine can do. So maybe pick up the story here.
To finish off briefly, just my observation on that. The human process of making any decision, whether it's getting up in the morning and having tea or coffee or getting in the car or getting whatever it is, we're based on certainty. When we decide to do X over Y, we're reasonably certain X is the right thing. And in the investment world, whether it's analyst through CIO, if there's lots and lots of data points telling you that everything's fine, as Doug mentioned, everything's fine before it's not, and you're certain that when you bought or shorted that company, that was the right thing to do, invariably, you're going to block out any news to the contrary. It's just human nature. So what we've based our business on is bringing a strong probability layer into that world of human certainty to create a healthy friction between analyst and PM, PM and risk, CIO and trading team. It simply brings in a bias-free view of, on a probability basis, this looks like something's changed. Do we still feel as strongly about that? And that's not to challenge the thesis from owning company X over company Y. It's simply to say that, do we feel comfortable with the risk allocated to X over Y based on this new information that is often discounted in a non-machine framework?
Yeah, I think that's a good outline. Doug, do you want to carry on?
Yeah, Wirecard to me is just a really, really great example of why we do what we do and why we're good at what we do. The way Wirecard played out is really classical. And as David said, the pattern of collapse in a company is a bit like that kind of saying about history, right? It doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Like the pattern of collapse in a company is, David and I live and breathe company collapses like day in, day out. So you see there's a rhythm, there's a shape to them that is so predictable. And it usually crystallizes into one of two or three events, which is like a kind of earnings or dividend collapse, an asset impairment, cap structure event, or like a rep risk or fraud or a scandal. And there's really, the way I think of it is like a pinball game. So the ball goes up and it pings around and it falls through one of those four slots when it actually collapses. But as the ball is pinging around at the top, there are a lot of different targets it can hit that will flash a light or make a sound. And you need to have lots of different targets on the board to really understand that this is a collapse playing out, because the ball's path is random and it hits in different order every time. And, when I was talking about the fact that we look at different data sets and sparse data points, I'll tell you exactly what we saw in Wirecard and how that played out. And it'll give you a really good example of like what this looks like for real. So for those who followed this company, obviously, Dan McCrum at the FT was writing about it from 2015 onwards, and it was very obvious there was something going on in this company. And, like a lot of roll-ups where you have, constant mergers, acquisitions, and you're sort of washing the core value of the company and it's getting bigger and bigger and you don't know how much of that is real. And it's growing and growing and everyone's happy because it's going up, and everyone either owns it because they like the leverage and they like the outsized growth, or frankly, they just have to own it because it's a peer group problem or a benchmark problem. So everybody owns it and, some people know there's a problem, but no one cares. There's a point through 2017-18 where our fundamental red flags started to ping. And as David said, that's things like, changes in accounting practice and behavior, abnormalities, things that just look statistically abnormal within the pattern of what's going on in the accounts. And at the same time, we actually saw a little bit of selling by conviction equity holders. So equity holders who had traditionally been overweight the name relative to benchmark had started to kind of take money out of it. So there's a slight softening in the cap table and there's fundamental red flags, two or three of them. But no one cares, right? The company's going up and up and up. But at that point, and to mix metaphors or jump metaphors, which I know I'm guilty of, I sometimes think of it also like a Venus flytrap. Like the Venus flytrap is open, the fly lands on it, it wanders around, and it doesn't close until it triggers it the second time, and then it closes. And that's often what you get. So the company has a trigger, it's open. You've got this gaping maw of a company where there's accounting irregularities. And those who are in the ESG kind of framework obviously talk about things like the MSCI accounting indices. So the ESG scores for Wirecard were fine. They were like, it's okay into the collapse. But the granular accounting quality score was very bad. But it was very bad for a very long time. And this is a super, super important point. Companies that have collapses, as I said, are non-linear. So they often have problems that are there for a very long time that no one cares about. And so it's not about finding problems that are actually that hard to find, because everyone who knows anything about Wirecard knew the accounting was a little bit questionable. The key to all of this is knowing, when should you actually do something about that? When should you care about it? And, you know, in this industry, as I said, like with no returns out there and no inflation and no growth, companies that lever up, it's a good thing, right? Because they outgrow, they generate returns. So people actively want to hold those companies until they don't. So this timing piece is really, really important. And Wirecard, the way that played out was as follows. You had the pre-existing accounting flags. You had some weakening in conviction. You then had some selling by large bondholders. So those are the three pieces that kind of tell you your jaws are open. You then have abnormal short pressure and short clustering, which obviously comes in around the time of the Zatara short attack. So, you know, because we're looking at treasury exhaust data on, you know, on shorts, we can see that abnormality. So we pick that up. Then obviously the machine reading algorithms pick up all the event news around, you know, the Zatara short issue and the kind of the tensions around short selling and the short selling ban in the company. So you follow that narrative and you see a surge and a cluster of event risk. What's interesting is that after the collapse of that, you then see smart money equity holders sell the company. They reduce their exposure. So those who are outperformance equity fund managers who own the name remove money out of the cap table in the aftermath of that. So if you remember, it did that kind of like boom, and then it kind of V-shaped. In that, you saw smart money coming out. Then what you have is the kind of, you know, the little run. Then you have the event spike around the fraud. That, I mean, does come out of nowhere. There's no, realistically, there's no easy way to see that that is coming. But obviously we catch it like everybody does, because we can read and the algorithms can read like a human being. But you catch that, then you see more smart money selling. Then as it's running and kind of stabilized for, you know, months and months, you see, you know, a resurgence of event risk, and you see a breakdown in leading analyst forecasts. So take the analysts on the sell side who are, you know, historically accurate on the name, which means they're probably close to management or they're just very good at their job. Their forecasts relative to everyone else start to deteriorate and drop off. So what you then see is, you know, the behavioral framework around this company and the market construct around the company is eroding. And that's the key piece, because that's what creates the conditions for collapse. It's the fundamental problem plus the breakdown in the behavioral framework of the company. And that's why it goes. And we, you know, we were very, I would say fortunate, but I mean, it's not. We had it on risk watch at a very, very good time ahead of both collapses. We had it obviously around the short and ahead of the fraud probe. And then again, before the eventual collapse. But if you think about what I just listed, there's 7 to 10 different pieces of information. Think of each one as one of the targets on our pinball game. So short pressure triggers once over 2 or 3 years. Analyst leader breakdown, let's say once or twice over a couple of years. You know, financial accruals and accounting flags, couple of those. You know, conviction selling, smart money selling, bond selling. So, you know, event risk, 2 or 3 of those. So what I've got is, you know, let's say 7 to 10 different triggers, but they all come from different parts of the kind of information that I could be monitoring around that company. And as I describe it to you, you know, you and David and I as human beings and anyone listening who's ever looked at a company, that totally makes sense. If I say to you, bad news comes out, company collapses, smart money holders get out, you would be like, well, that's not good. That is a common sense way of looking at a company. And that's what we do. So that's what we do. And it sounds prosaic and it's not super, super complicated. It's actually very, very simple. What's difficult is to try and get an algorithm or a machine or an AI to do that. You know, that's why we work in the field of like genuine AI, because as I said earlier, when we talked about the way a traditional quant model works, that's not how a quant model works. That's not how, you know, that's how a human being thinks. So to be able to do that and take in all of those different pieces of information and see the pattern emerging between them and combine them to one view of the company, that's where you have to, you know, invent new maths and new technologies. And that's where you have to be quite cutting edge. And that's the complexity of what we do. But as I said, although it's very, very complex, it's also pretty simple. You know, and hopefully that gives you an idea of not just like Wirecard itself, but that's what we do. It's the understanding of not just finding companies that have a fundamental problem, because there's loads of those, right? The market is full of them because we've had 10 years of free debt. So every company in the world is massively levered, and most of them have weak balance sheets or, you know, capital structure stress that could come out. The key point is you can't just not be positioned in any company. You need to know, right, which ones are safer than others and which ones should I do something about?
So that's an interesting point to look at. So first of all, before I dig into that, you've talked so far, both of you, about equities and credit, right? Because you're talking about the company level. Is that like, take us down your thinking of equities and fixed income to see whether there's a difference in approach or view.
Yeah. I mean, so equities obviously are, I mean, they're not easier, but obviously equities, you have, a live mark-to-market print. So you can see there's obviously market data and market analytics you can run in equity because the volume of available data is much higher. You can also obviously train models against equity play out because there's an observable variable to train against. And so, you know, equity is a good starting point. I think for that reason, there's been a lot more automation, a lot more AI machine learning application in equity than there has in credit. I think it's fair to say the credit world, it hasn't had as much of this kind of technology brought to play in it as equity has. And that's something we hear from a lot of clients and peers in the industry. But the reality is a company collapse is a company collapse. And what you'll often find is companies on their way to credit default will pass through many stations on that train. And, you know, earnings miss, dividend cut, equity price weakness, you know, a lot of the same points on that journey take you to a credit default. And so we have some very large strategic clients in credit where we work very closely on default risk and downgrade risk. Because if you think credit's got the same problem, what I described about the way the quant industry works in equity, think about how the ratings agency works. The ratings agency is using static, backwards-looking data and usually kind of blunt force rules, which is size is good, you know, leverage is bad, cash is good. It has inbuilt bias around sector and style. And it's kind of sat there looking backwards. So a tail risk, it's not going to catch. And anything idiosyncratic, it's not going to catch. And everybody knows that, right? The ratings agencies are usually very late. But even with outlook downgrades, they're usually a little bit late as well. And, you know, what we found is we have found that we're able to lead ratings agency downgrades and outlook changes by about 6 months or so, you know, in some cases much more, just because we can understand a lot more of the moving parts, you know, and it's part of it is all the things we look at in equity will play into that. But then obviously there are certain elements that are credit specific that you look at, right? Certain elements of a company are more important in credit than they would be in equity. And obviously some things can stay quite shallow in the cap structure. There might be equity volatility, but it doesn't get deep enough to hurt the credit guys. But we've found that as we've gone on the journey, we've ended up working quite deeply in credit. And, you know, I know China is something that has been very topical recently. You know, China Fortune Land default at the start of the year was a name that we were very active in. And this kind of big burst of SOE defaults and Chinese credit defaults, you know, we've been very successful in that. And we've had a lot of those that we've predicted and that we've been quite accurate on.
Yeah, that's. I don't want to go too deep into China, but look, the interesting thing there is you have this potential bogey that of the government intervening in some of these companies. So it's been interesting this year to see that they've stepped away from that, which I think is one of those unpredictable events that I think actually hopefully the market will be more predictable now, and it'll be back to more sort of fundamental analysis.
I mean, you're right there. The moral hazard in China credit is astronomical because there's been an implied state guarantee for so long. And I think I saw a stat that 35% of all of last year's credit defaults in China were state-owned enterprise. And, you know, so this is the thing. You don't have that implied. I mean, I think I wrote something in our company WhatsApp the other day where I was like, what people are learning is that the kind of unwritten government guarantee isn't worth the paper it isn't written on, right? People are learning that these companies have no backstop. And, you know, we had the first commercial bank bankruptcy since the start of the 2000s. So the banks can't give you free money anymore. You had like 16 delistings. So they'll delist companies now, which they didn't used to do. You know, we had 2019, we had a big collapse, Kangmei Farm, which had like a $12 billion accounting fraud. The fine that the company received for doing that, $84,000. It got a slap on the wrist. It was allowed to retire its debt, you know, in sort of friendly terms with government support. I mean, that was 2019. I think 2020 it's marked a huge sea change in what's happening. And you've seen there's like is it 1.3 trillion of China debt maturities coming up in the next year? It's going to be horrifying. But this is the thing. When you look at the ratings agency, China Fortune Land, which, as I said, defaulted in Q1 and we predicted, if you read the ratings agency report on that name, it was given a higher rating than it should have fundamentally because of an implied support from a major shareholder. Because there's a layer of human bias and assumption baked into the rating that assumed that there would be a backstop from the major shareholder, and there wasn't. And, you know, there's still a lot of this out there. And that's why it goes back to what David said about Wirecard. Emmeline, our AI, has no emotion, has no opinion. We don't put ratings on companies. We don't say buy, sell, hold, because actually it's our client's job to make a decision what they want to do with a position. All we do is observe facts and state them and say what the levels of risk are and how confident we are. And then, you know, we don't preempt a decision, which makes us a little bit different to an industry research house or a ratings agency. We just, and as that goes back to what we were saying earlier, we're trying to actually augment the smart humans in the industry by giving them the capacity to make more decisions at scale with precision. We're not trying to do their job for them and take those decisions.
And so that's kind of how it's, go ahead, David.
Sorry, right? It's, you know, it's not a trivial point. I think it's a point that we labor whenever we speak for a prospective new customer is where our process stops, your process begins. And it's really important that we understand where those lines in the sand are, what are those triggers, so that we can tailor Emmeline to essentially prompt you into action at the point of need. But certainly we see, and Doug mentioned before, the mathematical calculation layer that's available to us at the moment is miles from replicating the human mind, miles and miles and miles. So what are machines good at doing? And let's leverage them for doing those jobs. Automating a lot of the lower value tasks, information aggregation, looking for deviation from pattern, reading, which I still to this day, hand on heart, believe is a redundant task except for joy. You know, looking at waves of information and looking for those patterns that machines are very good at doing with both eyes open, fantastic, do that. As opposed to coming in each morning, having to read the newspapers, look at your Bloomberg alerts, oh, there's a company financials reported, dig through 400 pages of financials. No. Let's let the machines do that job, because what they can't do is make that subjective choice piece. And so those roles and responsibilities that we work on really heavily with our customers in terms of what is BlueFi good at, where do we stop in our process and where does your process begin, I think is a really important piece, because certainly, you know, there is a threat around technology. And hopefully part of this discussion today is to put to rest some of that fear. The machines aren't coming for your job if you're good at doing your job. If you're not doing a very good job of it anyway, then you should be worried for many other reasons. But certainly the automation layer that's there is designed, or certainly what we've designed in our process is to enhance the the smart human layer. Take away those lower value jobs, free up time so that you can do much higher value jobs that are uniquely human. It's a really important point.
Yeah, so I think if I could just correct something you said, most reading is a waste of time. Reading like the stuff from PeerPoint, for instance, incredibly valuable, and people should.
Well, I did say for joy, Roy. I did say for joy. So, you know, I'm not redacting that. I read that for joy.
An excellent point, and I think many people out there will agree. So, what I was just going to quickly interject there was, so I guess in what you were just describing, Doug, and David, you've just kind of expanded on that. That's the difference between what your tool does and what an algo does, because an algo makes a decision, makes the trade based on the data that it has, and there's no human intervention. They said, we're just doing that. We're buying or we're selling that, and we're reversing that at some other future point. Whereas what you're saying is, we're going to collect up all this data and we're going to give you some warning flags, and then it's up to you whether you decide to do something or not.
I mean, it kind of depends. We do both, depending on what the client needs. So obviously the way we look at, as David said, the way we look at companies is, I don't think it's unreasonable to say we are very, very far ahead of the incumbent kind of quantitative way of looking at companies. So, you know, when we work with systematic clients or clients who want us to take it to an end decision, we can go quite far down that journey. Like, we can produce a decision. And, you know, I think we had some stats. If you literally just sold every company we flagged as severe risk back to 2017, you know, they're not all right. How could they be? But if you just sold every single one of them, the average annualized return on those would be 15.8% negative, index adjusted. I mean, that's a phenomenally good short book. If you just literally, and that's, you know, we've had 30,000 odd downgrades back to 2017 on our universe. So what we're saying is that, you know, if you just blindly followed us, there is value, and statistically there's an accuracy that you can rely on our flags and our risk status quite heavily. But it's more, I think, that most humans and most people in the industry aren't ready for that. It's like autonomous driving, right? You know, the industry could produce self-driving cars tomorrow, but people don't want that. They're not ready. They want to have a hand on a steering wheel. They want to have a manual override. And so, you know, we have some clients where they are hungry to go further down that road and they want to go further. And we do deliver systematically into client strategies that use us that way. But what we find is the bulk of the industry is human beings who aren't ready yet to do that, right? Where you've got a status quo business that you can't just automatically disrupt. You can't replace it like that. And the machines aren't ready to do it. So that's where we do a lot of work on augmentation. And, you know, as David said, we're adding scale, basically scale and precision to smart humans so they can just do exactly what they do and just do more of it, you know, or do it quicker.
Right. So I just want to do one clarification. Then I want to move for maybe the last point into kind of the human side of things here. But even where you're providing input into systematic trading, you're providing input to it, right? You know, there is whatever in their model is, they might have other factors, and that might be, you know, largely reliant on you or partially reliant on you or just part of it. But are you saying that some people use it just like follow through completely?
Yeah. So most of our systematic clients, it will be used as, you know, think of it almost like a factor for idiosyncratic risk. So when you're looking at Axioma or Barra and you've got that unexplained little stub, imagine that we're just one line, one column in the spreadsheet that fills that gap. So you actually have something in there that you know what to do. And so we feed systematic processes that have lots of different inputs. We do, however, have, you know, as part of our business, there is a US absolute return strategy that has been created running purely on our models. And that is, I mean, purely run just from our risk frameworks and our view of companies, our asset selection. And that fund, I think, did about 20% last year, and it outperformed both hedge fund returns, you know, industry proxy and the S&P quite handily. Because it's, you know, it's able to manage a very high volume of ideas with something approaching, you know, as a not at the full level that a human PM or analyst could do them, but no human analyst can do 500 active ideas at any time. And so it's, as I said, it sits ahead of where traditional quant would be. But it's, you know, that is, you know, we're doing that. And then, you know, we've looked at China absolute return because there's a lot of demand for that too. But, you know, as I said, we do have some evidence that you can run, you know, you can run a strategy off this and it works pretty well.
Well, look, I think that that in itself is really fascinating. So if we're truly in the golden age of fraud, as Jim Chanos says, then you know, people be queuing up for this, I would expect. But it seems to me that if we turn to the human side of it, it must be, being a PM must be incredibly difficult now. Because there are so many companies, portfolios are bigger, right? There's just more money to manage and everyone focuses on scale. There's the challenge that that passive investing sort of presents and sort of you have to align yourself accordingly there. But globalization of companies must also be a factor. You know, all these companies will be filing in their individual countries according to local standards. And, you know, the CEO in one country doesn't know the head of other countries' subsidiaries. So it seems to me to be a massive challenge to do this. So why doesn't everyone use this? Like, why wouldn't everyone use this as part of their analysis process? You shouldn't have time to be talking to me because you're so busy setting up new customers.
Next salesperson, Doug.
I know, but where's
the contract?
I mean, look, you know, I'll let David talk a little bit more about this because David works on the distribution side and is very active in probably selling into one of the more fundamental and traditional markets on earth. But I mean, what I will say is, you know, it's undeniable. We are extremely busy. You know, our coverage of companies has skyrocketed over the last year. What we saw was, I think that 2020 marked a big turning point for a lot of people, because I think up until 2020, a lot of people were very reluctant. There was a lot of innovation theater going on. A lot of people wanted to do AI or do machine learning. And what that meant was doing workshops on it or giving talks and webinars. But really, what people wanted to do with technology was automate the middle and back office, make the process faster and cheaper, do the front end, have a shiny website, customer acquisition, customer journey. But the core product, the core business of decision making, of investment manufacturing, risk management, positioning, you know, the actual core risk decision has been left alone for a very long time. Because let's be honest, what's the capital market's founding principle? It's the belief that smart humans can outperform the market. So to bring a machine into that is almost sacrilege to a lot of people. And it strikes very deep and it's quite visceral change to try and involve machines in that, which is why, let's be honest, most firms that have quant and fundamental almost run them in parallel. If we're honest, you know, they're not really mixing that much because of that core belief. I think 2020 shook up a lot of people because the quant models all broke and the humans kind of broke too, because it's fine if you've got a portfolio of 100 companies and you've got one Wirecard every 5 years, or you've got, you know, two or three Volkswagens or like volatile companies with a lot of noise and, you know, movement. If suddenly you've got 10, 20, 30 of those companies or 20 or 30 potential Wirecards and you don't know which one is which, you can't deal with that. And I think the fundamental breakdown and the shock people got in Q1 of last year, where they didn't even know where the risk was in the portfolio and none of their quant tools could help them, made people realize that, you know, this ring-fenced old business that has been left alone, it has to change and it has to be investigated and innovated. And I think, you know, certainly over here in Europe, what I've seen is, you know, and we did a residency with the Investment Association and we work quite closely with UK Asset Management. There's a real change in mentality where people are much more willing to bring machine intelligence into kind of investment decision-making and risk. And so if we try and speak to you in 6 months, 12 months, yeah, I mean, at the rate things are going, we are very, very busy. But, you know, as I said, we are seeing just the very beginnings of tech finally breaking into the stronghold of human decision making, and finding that balance and the way that works, it's not easy, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of finesse. And maybe David can talk a bit more, because I think obviously Australia is probably one of the most traditional kind of human driven asset management and banking markets. And I know, you know, David obviously works distribution there. So maybe you can talk a bit more about what that process is and how you go through that.
Yeah, David, before I do that, I should actually just let viewers know that it has taken us months to get this time scheduled. So I wasn't suggesting that you weren't busy. So I want to be clear about that. But we've been talking about this for a long time, and it's been a challenge. It's been a challenge to schedule. So David, over to you. Humans, who wants them?
Humans, well, everyone, and sadly I am one. Can't get away from that. I'm looking for my digital double, but haven't found him yet. The sale process, I mean, I think I was the first salesperson to join the company in 2017. So I've seen what that journey's been like, what the product has looked like from then through to now, what the conversations have been from the very early days through to now. And I think we didn't do well enough at defining the problem early on, and we really hadn't got market fit right and the product type right. And we really had to think, and you know, any fintech who might be watching this, I would encourage you to think long and hard about what is that problem you're solving. Be rigorous, be ruthless around defining it, because we tried to sell many things early on. And like I remember a very specific meeting in Melbourne, and we just got slapped. And go, guys, go away. You're trying to sell us 10 different things here. Just forget about it. All too hard. So we've gotten really good at defining what the problem is and where we play into that. And the whole idea that digital innovation has to involve an entire enterprise-wide change, no. Fintech should be about improving one thing, making one small thing better. We use the analogy of the wheel. Take out a steel spoke, change it with a carbon fiber bladed spoke, wheel moves a bit quicker. We're about changing spokes. Australia is an interesting one. You know, it's a market that really didn't suffer in the GFC. And so very early on when we were trying to push a risk business in this country, I think we had 138 no's in a row that said, well, we look at our profile throughout the GFC, we've got a great risk process. Obviously, recent experience has probably challenged that. And, you know, we've been called back into a number of discussions, which is great. We're lucky enough to have a very large asset manager in Australia partner with us, and we're really fortunate to have them on board because we've learned a lot from that engagement as well. But, you know, not to go too deep into it, what I do see is that 2020 was transformative. I like to say the analogy, up to that point, I was always making outbound calls. Now my phone rings, which is a really fortunate place to be when I'm stuck in these four walls every day. But I think the street is coming to the idea, and maybe that's because they've tried to develop what we've done, what other fintech have tried to do as well, and whatever degrees of success they've had with that, maybe they remember a conversation at Bluefire and say, we've just spent millions of dollars trying to automate this. We didn't know what question to ask of the data. We don't want to aggregate the data. The classifiers are all wrong. Hey, let's get Bluefire back, because it sounded like they had something way back when. And those conversations now seem to have a lot more links to them. I think one of the other changes that we've seen is the propensity for a lot of the sell-side platforms to look to partner with fintech in dashboard availabilities to their own customers. That seems to be a trend that is accelerating. We first sort of heard the rumors around that in 2019. Some of the custodians looking at what other value-add sources they could provide to their custody clients. Where we sit today, there's active conversations going on around the world as to how Bluefire will plug into dashboards that banks, custodians, exchanges, and data providers will offer out to their customers, which is a really exciting phase for us to be involved in as well, because you know, Bluefire is never going to solve all the problem, but we are very, very good at that unforeseen risk piece, and it's nice to have a conversation with someone who's open and go, hey, this is actually quite cool what you guys are doing. I can see how that would fit into my business. So it does seem it's a more open discussion. And I think the other element there that can't be underestimated is human nature is no one likes to be first. So, you know, roll back to 2017, who's Bluefire? No one's ever heard of us. Difficult business card to try and get out the door. 2021, there's a little bit of profile starting to grow. And, you know, I'm thankful again for your time today, Roy, to help move that forward just a little bit again. But, you know, that it can't be underestimated that the industry doesn't like change. It's allergic to new. And that's just a function of human nature, and we have to be sensitive to that. We've all had to get our heads around that as we've worked in the business, because we are in the business of inventing new. And sometimes that's a difficult and awkward process for us internally, because there are these rigorous debates around, is this the right or the wrong thing to do? And some of those arguments internally are pretty heated, because we're passionate about getting it right. We have to get it right. You know, there's a saying internal, no plan B, but we have to get this right. It's important to us, and we're beholden to getting it right for our customers, because we see it's important.
Great. Well, look, I think what I'm hearing from you guys is kind of what I said at the start, which is, to me, you know, we've been talking about AI for a long time, and, you know, Doug, you touched on it, and, you know, what does AI really mean? Well, you know, often, you know, people talk about robotics and what they describe it as if it's AI, right? And it's not really about any kind of machine learning or really enhancing sort of the human thought process. So I think these are still the early days. So I'm not surprised to hear that it's kind of trending, because it's like anything. You need to say how can something actually be used to make our outcome better, and that comes through use cases and proof. And you know, I've coined this phrase. People have heard me use it. You know, people talk about wanting to innovate, and they don't really want to innovate. What they want to do is later-vate. They want someone else to innovate, prove that it works, and then they'll do it later. So I think that's it. And again, you mentioned LinkedIn. There was something on LinkedIn where someone commented that, you know, you can tell when someone's old because they don't want to innovate. And my comment on that in LinkedIn was, then I meet a lot of old people every day, right? Because it is difficult, right? The market and people's position in the market and their success to date is based on the current infrastructure and the current competitive marketplace. And anything that disrupts that threatens their position, right? And so, you know, people would rather not innovate in many cases and take a risk that they won't come out a winner at the end of it, then actually give it a try. So for all of this sort of agile sort of, we're going to try something, and if we fail, that's okay, because we found one way that doesn't work and we're going to try a different way. That's hard to do. It's just conceptually hard to do, and I think it's generational. So I don't know if you guys have any sort of maybe some final thoughts, because no doubt you have to sell some more customers, implement more customers, and refine your development. So,
And one thing before, I'll let David kind of close out, but one thing, what you just said did trigger a thought that I did want to mention. So you may kind of mention about equity and credit earlier, what you were saying about the kind of the reluctance to innovate. It's very interesting working with equity and credit people in the industry and different kind of people in the different fields within the trading floor, because what you tend to find is there are very different adjacencies to risk and capital in the industry, and there's different capacity constraints. So think about the average equity analyst, research analyst, they might cover 15, 20 stocks. The average credit analyst might be covering 100 issuers. You know, so credit, what you found is that, you know, in credit, the capacity constraint is visceral. It's very, you know, it's difficult. And obviously nonlinear collapse and default is terrifying, and the data points are harder to spot. So credit people feel this, and there's a natural understanding that, look, I just can't physically do everything. I could, you know, I could use some backup. That's not threatening to me. That's sort of helpful to me. I'm not saying it's 100% easy, but it's much more of a natural understanding of that capacity constraint and, you know, and that need for precision. In equity, I think I saw the stat somewhere of how many equity research analysts there are in the industry. It's a huge amount. And, you know, when you think about it in equities, you obviously automating and adding scale isn't necessarily a good thing if you've got a research department full of people whose job is to cover 8, 10, 15, 20 companies, you know, and that's all that they do. You know, obviously, if you could condense and have two people do the work of 20 people, that's not a good thing. And so what we found is that in equities, you know, whereas in credit, let's say research use us a lot, in equities we'll sit more with trading or the prime, you know, the fund management, portfolio management layer, where they're monitoring at scale, or they're close enough to capital and risk that they value the precision. But it is very different throughout the industry, you know, place by place. it really depends. Like you said, you know, people will feel more or less threatened by innovation depending on effectively, you know, what their capacity is and how hard the connection is between them and real capital or real risk and returns. And that's a sort of rule of thumb, I think, that is playing out. But anyway, I mean, David, I don't know if you want to kind of wrap things up, but I just wanted to drop those in there because I know we talked about equity and credit earlier.
I think that's a really interesting difference, which I wasn't really aware of. But obviously the number of analysts today, although large, is nothing like it used to be. And so, you know, that trend is going to continue. You know, I don't see anyone really sort of falling over themselves to, you know, double the size of the research department. You know,
of course, the after MiFID II, obviously, the buy side can't outsource research to the sell side in the same way, because obviously research provision is being scaled back. So, you know, these are all problems that I think will follow through into equities over time.
Great. Thanks, Doug. David, last word to you.
Yeah, I don't have a great, I think we've covered a lot of territory today, and I thank you for the opportunity to just speak with you and hopefully demystify some of the concerns around what is AI. It's a term that's bandied around a lot. We have to be able to reverse engineer and show our customers where things come from. Otherwise, we generally don't have a business. But there is an advantage in having a scalable tool. And so certainly from our experience, we do see an industry that's coming in our direction. And we welcome discussions from anyone who is interested in having a look at a practical application of how just a small piece of infrastructure can be improved. Because the day of the human trader, analyst, PM, CIO is not getting easier. Yield compression, fee pressure, it's an industry that is increasingly asked to do more by less people. And so we're simply trying to play into that and to help our former and soon-to-be new colleagues in that space.
Yeah, look, I think that's a great wrap-up. And from my perspective, the reason I was so keen on doing this session with you guys is because from our conversations, you know, we've talked about several practical applications, I think, for the securities finance space where this makes a whole lot of sense. So I encourage people to talk to you guys or reach out to me and talk about your ideas or ask questions. This is, to me, going back to what I was talking about, in the 90s, we were kind of creating international prime brokerage. I think what we're at the stage of now is AI as having a really critical role to play in the future of how we risk manage our businesses, whatever aspect they are, but specifically in securities finance, I think this can make a difference today. So thanks, guys. Much appreciated. And I'll let you get back to work now. So thanks. Great.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Doug.
Cheers.
All of us. Good evening.
Before I get to my summary of the show, what I want to do is make a quick pitch. This show is brought to you by Pierpoint Financial, where we make a ton of free content available on securities finance. In addition to these podcasts, we also do a weekly blog. We do twice weekly live streams on Wednesdays and Saturdays. And we also provide free primers as well as our paid for courses. But this, of course, costs time and money. And if you find the content helpful and want the shows to remain ad-free, then we need your help. And by help, I mean, I'd like you to buy me a coffee at our Buy Me a Coffee page. And there'll be details in the show description. Look, a simple one-off donation is really super appreciated and helpful. And we also have monthly recurring memberships with different benefits, including access to one of our monthly Q&A sessions for exclusive members only. I drink a lot of coffee, and I'd appreciate it if you buy me one. As I said, the link is in the show description. Now let's get back to the summary. I'm so excited about what I learned today, and I think we have a glimpse of how the industry might develop in the not-too-distant future. The key here is that Bluefire is augmenting human decision-making in a way that just isn't possible by adding more people or, frankly, really in any other way. David took us through the changing attitudes of prospective users as they grapple with the challenges of dealing with so many factors influencing investment decisions. I love David's description of where AI ends, the human begins. Doug's analogy of a pinball machine is one of the best I've heard and was a perfect description of those many factors and really symbolizes just how difficult it is for anyone to really be able to identify all of the different items and put it together, resulting in sort of a coherent judgment about a stock or a bond. And listening to Doug, you can tell his deep and rich experience in dealing with analysts and risk managers and the challenges they face. One of the most surprising aspects that I took away from both David and Doug is, as they explained throughout, AI today is just nowhere near matching or replacing what human thinking can do. But its job is to gather and assess data that isn't humanly possible and lay it out for people to exercise their decision-making in a way which only people can do. It's the accumulation of those various disparate events that's both the necessary catalyst for decision-making, but also the thing making it most difficult to achieve. I'm not surprised, however, that this is also useful for systematic trading, whether resulting in fully automated executions, as Doug pointed out, or nearly automated. Nevertheless, the challenges that AI presents to the status quo and the people in any profession, including securities finance, is that they tend to avoid change. Yeah, we all know that change is a constant and evolution is necessary for the success and survival of the species or the business. And that's why I've been so intrigued by the Blue Fire product. As I mentioned earlier, I have some thoughts on how this could be used, and I'd love to hear yours. So feel free to drop me a line, and I'd love to have a chat with you. The episode, I think, is just filled with great quotes, and I will repeat the one that I think I may even steal if I can. David said, "We are in the business of inventing new." And I have to say, I really love that. Right. There's your introduction to Blue Fire and how they're using AI to improve and enhance risk management and investment decision making. I hope you enjoyed the episode, as I think it's probably obvious I did. As always, we encourage you to share topics or guests that you'd like to hear from. So drop me a line at roy@peerpoint.info. And if you're watching on video, you can leave comments. And of course, we'll respond to those. We provide lots of free securities finance content, which can be found at our website, www.peerpoint.info. We're active on LinkedIn and Facebook as Peerpoint Financial Consulting and on Twitter as Peerpoint FC. I'm Roy Zimmerhansel. This has been Peerpoint Perspectives, the art of securities finance, and I look forward to catching you next time.